Black and brown students, they're low-income students. These are students with, you know, trauma, with high needs. And so I try to make my classroom as welcoming as I can, right? And I let them know that I care about them. But it's not necessarily the picture that is painted when I don't have a seat for them, right? It's not necessarily the scene that's, you know, painted for them when they can't see the board because they're all the way in the back behind, you know, 40 kids.
Angelica Reyes, a high school teacher at Santee Education Complex in Central LA. We are in day 4 of the teacher strike here, and it looks like there could be some progress towards a resolution today. The teachers union and the district are talking today for the first time in a week. The two sides are meeting at City Hall so the mayor's office can help them reach an agreement, but without Eric Garcetti, he had another meeting to go to. The district says it's losing up to $15 million a day because funding is tied to student attendance and most students are not showing up. KCRW reporter Jenny Hamill was in Central LA this morning where teachers met with parents, parents who have been complaining that they are not getting good information about what's going on. Both schools that she went to serve predominantly low-income minority students. Hi, Jenny.
Hi, Madeline.
Well, tell us about them. This is San Pedro Street Elementary and Santee Education Complex. Why was this meeting called today?
Right. So both schools are in Central LA, predominantly black and brown students. Almost all the kids, about 90% of the students at both San Pedro Street and Santee, are eligible for free and reduced lunches. They have sizable groups of English language learners at their schools. The meeting was held entirely in Spanish. They had a translator sit next to me so I could hear what the teachers and parents were saying and understand them. The parents were updated on how the negotiations are going. They were kind of instructed on how to call the district to lodge their complaints about classroom size, other issues. And they were there to get the correct information.
Right. And so have students not been going during the strike?
So it's interesting. Let's talk about San Pedro Street Elementary. On the first day, 183 out of 700 did attend. Now, on the second day of the strike, there was a big spike up to 283 kids. And it's interesting because a lot of the parents said they had gotten the message from Spanish-speaking news outlets that kids would be marked truant, they would get in trouble if they didn't go to school during the strike. And they're thinking that that spike on the second day reflected that. I talked to a parent, Delia Herrera, who said she was getting that kind of information from Spanish-speaking news.
In Spanish, like, they'd say it's up to the principal. But then again, I hear or see papers that say no, it's not going to affect them. So that's why I came here to this reunion to find out more about the attendance and also
whether your kids would get in trouble if they didn't go to school.
Yes.
But today there was only 120 kids out of 700, so it's dipped significantly.
Yeah. And say, she said something interesting there about the message she's getting from Spanish media. How is the message she heard different from what English media is saying?
I think there's a general perception that English news outlets are giving correct information. Like, one, there will be a strike, and that district policy is that students won't be marked truant, aren't under threat of not graduating if they don't go to school during the strike.
All right. So why are parents keeping their kids at home, the ones who are?
Well, there was one dad at the meeting who told the entire group that his son has ADHD, takes medicine for it. And when he asked the school if anyone would be able to give his son the medicine during the strike, they said, you know, simply no. So he felt it wasn't safe. And other parents have felt the same way about safety issues.
Okay. And you went to another school in West Adams and talked to parents and educators there about how this strike is affecting its students. What did you find out?
I talked to a teacher named Philip Murphy. His class filled with kids who have autism, severe cognitive disorders, some 10-year-olds in diapers, are completely nonverbal. The reason why he's striking, he says, because he has too many of those students that he has to deal with. This is what he told parents about the strike.
I said, your kids are still going to have those excellent TAs. So, you know, if you don't want to send them, I'm sure they'll be safe. You know, they're not going to be abused. They're not going to be, you know, just running around loose. They'll be okay. I will not be here working on their individualized education plans, their IEPs. We won't be doing a whole lot of academic anything. But, you know, if you just need the respite care, you can certainly send your kids. Or if you feel better keeping them home, keep them home.
So So Murphy said it's been a mixed bag. Some parents keeping them home, some parents, you know, having no choice but to send them to school.
So broadly speaking, if this strike continues to go on, what's at stake for the neediest families, the ones who can't stay home with their kids, the kids who rely on schools for their meals, two or three meals out of the day, or who need special ed services?
Well, I mean, I think the answer is pretty clear. They have to send their kids to school. And if even that includes, you know, sending them to an auditorium full of hundreds of kids, it's the only option they have.
All right. KCRW reporter Jenny Hamill, thank you so much.
Thanks, Madeline.
For now, negotiations are continuing with no clear end in sight. Both sides seem unwilling to budge on key issues like class size and staffing. Mayor Garcetti, after staying out of the fray, has now offered to mediate the negotiations. Joining us to discuss is David Tikofsky, education strategist and former LAUSD teacher and former school board member. Hi, David.
Hello.
All right. So you know this school board situation inside and out. You have looked at budgets. You have been on both sides, if you will, as a board member and as a union member. What do you think is happening? Do you think both sides are bargaining honestly?
Well, they've been talking past each other for months and months, since the superintendent arrived on that very split vote of 4-3 when Austin Buettner came in. I think they have to get real about their expectations and their language. The school district has been provoking by saying there's no money and perpetuating this story that there's a fiscal cliff in 3 years and the system's going to go bankrupt. And the union has found $1.8 billion and has used that figure, but it's safer to see that number as half of that. And let's get to work on the issues that matter. Delayed salary, class size, and the number of people who were cut in 2008 from the Great Recession.
Okay, let me just ask you about that $1.8 billion. That is the sticking point. The union saying that the district has this money. The district saying, no, we don't have it because we have all these future pension liabilities that we need to fund. So you're saying that there isn't even that $1.8 billion to begin with?
Oh, no, there is $1.8 billion, but some of it is attached to the pay raises anticipated and pay raises given and to some other matters. But the district describes it almost as if none of that money is available. And then when Gavin Newsom came out with his incredible budget the other day, the district belittled it rather than saying, thank you, this is a breath of incredibly good fresh air, and let's use that opportunity. Instead, the district trumpeted 10 measly million dollars from Proposition 63 and Proposition 2 on mental health that the county's been holding prisoner for over a decade now. So $10 million is $20 a kid. The amount of money of billions that the governor put in is reason to think that they can sit down and start mapping things out. And let me say, they're discussing a contract that would almost end this June.
Yeah, exactly. What do you think that the district could do without sacrificing its future, without going bankrupt?
Well, I don't think the district's going bankrupt. For the 12 years I was there, there was constantly that talk. Even the moment that it could have been horrendous, which was 2008, President Obama came through with an incredible stimulus that was over $1 billion of rescue money. And Governor Brown has helped with Prop 30 and one of the other propositions that brought the floor back up, and it's jumping by over $2 billion a year in public education. So I don't buy this we're all going to fall off the cliff rhetoric, and it's not very helpful. It's not very hopeful. It's a language of fear, and we know what parts of the country right now are perpetuating language of fear rather than the language of hope.
So what about this class size reduction then? Mm-hmm. What do you think the district could reasonably offer?
The district could probably, and they never break down like a Chinese menu, the different things you could order, but they certainly could do fourth and fifth grade.
They could reduce class sizes in fourth and fifth grade?
Absolutely.
To what?
Significantly. I would say by 8 kids.
Why fourth and fifth grade?
Well, first of all, K through 3 currently is at 24 by state law. By fourth grade, the kids are starting to read to learn. We say in K-3 they're learning to read. Now in 4th and 5th grade they get science, they get math. The kids' skill sets are from 9th grade to 1st grade. There's no TA in the room like there is in kindergarten, 1st grade. Kids begin to suffer in 4th and 5th grade, and then they hit middle school, and it becomes problematic. And as we know, a lot of them are not making it through high school in the way we want them to be.
All right, let's talk about the other big issue that the union has raised, and that is charter schools. This is the sort of the existential question for the district, how it's going to look with charters competing with district schools. What do you think the district should do to allay the union's fears about charter schools?
Well, superintendent ought to say one word. I mean, he hasn't said one word related to charter in this whole dialogue, and the teachers marched on the charter school headquarters. That's like saying there's no money. There's no discussion. There are ways in which you could have the district be the right of first refusal to bring these creative ideas, if they are creative, to the district and employ them in the district. This is a simple.
I mean, if someone came up with a charter school idea, they're like, I want to create a school centered around science, then you go to the district first and say, help me do this?
Yeah, absolutely right. Okay. Instead, everybody sends them to the charter office. And 3 months later, they come out of the intestine of the charter office, and they're a charter school, and they take revenue from the general fund. It's been 25 years of charter school reform led by two Democrats, Tom Hayden and Gary Hart. It's time to bring those kinds of reforms into the system rather than setting up a segregated system like we had in school districts around this country for decades.
But isn't that what magnet schools are?
Oh, yeah, and absolutely. Magnet schools can be affiliated charter magnets. Magnet schools are outperforming charter schools, and the superintendent not once has said that out loud to everybody. Our magnet schools are spectacular. Some of them need improvement, too, but they are outperforming these independent charter schools.
Do you think that this strike is going to be settled soon?
I don't see it. Certainly, by the day after Martin Luther King's birthday celebration this weekend.
So you think it'll go on through next week?
It could even go on the whole next week.
David Tikofsky, he is education strategist, a former LAUSD teacher, and a former school board member. David, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Coming up, does the head of the EPA believe in climate change? Yes. Does he think it's the most pressing environmental problem on the planet? That's next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. The government may be shut down, but some things are still going on, like hearings for people who run key parts of our government and make decisions that affect us all. One such person, Andrew Wheeler. His confirmation hearing to officially run the EPA took place yesterday. He's been acting chief for the last 6 months. He replaced Scott Pruitt, who resigned because of all those ethics problems. Well, Wheeler has already done a lot to undo environmental regulations. Democratic senators grilled him on that and on his views on global warming. Joining us now to talk about all this, Juliet Eilperin, senior national affairs correspondent for The Washington Post. Hi there.
Hi.
Well, tell us more about his background.
Well, certainly Andrew Wheeler is a veteran of Washington, having operated in both the legislative and executive branch as well as a lobbyist. So he had started out actually as a intern and career official at the Environmental Protection Agency, then went over to the Hill where he rose to be the staff director for conservative Senator James Inhofe at the Senate Environment and Public Works Committee.
Wait, he's the guy who brought the snowball onto the Senate floor?
Exactly, exactly. That one who has certainly questioned every aspect of human activity and its connection to climate change, as well as whether even global warming is happening and whether there's, you know, impacts. And then he left to go to K Street, to go to a firm where he earned a large amount of money representing different energy industries and other players.
Okay. So I think environmentalists would look at that and say, this is the fox guarding the hen house. Is that pretty much how it went down at the confirmation hearing yesterday, with this Democrat saying, are you really a good guardian of the environment?
Certainly. That's really the Democrats honed in on two things. One, what you're saying about kind of questioning whether, given his background and his work for private interests, whether he could be an impartial arbiter of what's going on. And then separately, they were also questioning, you know, to what extent he endorses President Trump's views on climate change. And so, you know, of course, the Republicans countered that. For example, a Republican from South Dakota, Kevin Cramer, said, should we bar farmers from being the head of the Department of Agriculture? Should we bar doctors from being the head of Health and Human Services and so forth? But that was certainly the line of questioning from Democrats and the criticism we've been hearing from environmentalists.
Well, what did he say about climate change, global warming?
So it was interesting. He said that he believes that human activities are contributing to climate change, and did not endorse, for example, President Trump's pre-presidential statement that climate change is a Chinese hoax. But at the same time, he, under sharp questioning from several Democrats, including Bernie Sanders of Vermont, refused to identify climate change as one of the most significant crises that the world faces today.
Do you agree with the scientific community that climate change is a global crisis that must be addressed in an aggressive way?
I believe that climate change is a global issue that must be addressed globally. No one country can...
That wasn't my question, sir. Do you agree with the scientific community?
I would not call it the greatest crisis, no, sir. I consider it a huge issue that has to be addressed globally.
Not the greatest crisis, although there was that big report that came out in November by 13 federal agencies that really did paint it as a great crisis, saying that global warming poses a profound threat to human life.
Exactly. And in that context, and, you know, that report did come up. And essentially, one of the things that Andrew Wheeler says when he's asked about that report is he didn't censor it, but he didn't read it before it came out.
So that means he wouldn't take actions to mitigate any of the problems raised in that report if he hasn't even read it.
Well, what his official line, which he reiterated, is he would note that for the most part, with the exception of, in fact, last year, America's greenhouse gas output has been declining, and he pointed to different ways in which that was happening, and said that you know, if you looked at some of the policies that have been advanced under the Trump administration, that there would continue to be some reductions in greenhouse gases linked to climate change. Although one of the interesting things is he pointed to increased energy efficiency, including fuel efficiency, when one of the trademark proposals that's come out since Andrew Wheeler has run the EPA is something that would freeze fuel efficiency standards for cars and light trucks for 6 years. So it was a kind of an interesting contrast between some of the policies he was identifying and what he's championed since he's been in office.
Right. And that is a big issue here in California, of course, easing these fuel economy standards. So when you look at Andrew Wheeler and you look at how he's running the EPA as compared to Scott Pruitt and environmental regulations, where does he fall? Is he basically carrying out what Scott Pruitt started, but in perhaps a more ethical way? Or is he doing something different?
He's really doing exactly what you said. He is essentially advancing almost every one of the same policies that were championed by Scott Pruitt, with very small differences. He's committed to deregulation and sees that as his role as Trump's deputy. And, you know, at the same time, he is certainly much friendlier towards career employees. He is more cognizant of some of the legal pitfalls that he might face as he tries to unravel these longstanding environmental protections. So he's doing it in certainly, many would say, a savvier way. But in terms of how does he line up ideologically with his predecessor, it's a very similar.
And what has he done that he's actually been able to carry out that hasn't been stymied in legal counterattacks?
Well, really, everything he's done are still in the process of going through the kind of the required process where they can't even quite get to the courts yet. So as we mentioned, the fuel efficiency rules, that's something that's been proposed, but it hasn't been finalized. The same would go for his push to ease carbon limits on from existing power plants. There still would be some limits, but it's a much more modest program than what Barack Obama authored. We've also seen he just recently, just last month, proposed changing the way you would define protected water in the in the United States, which would absolutely scale back kind of protections for small water supplies throughout the U.S. So, but all of these things are kind of still in the stages of going through the process. So I think the jury is out on whether all of these deregulatory initiatives he's championed ultimately become law or not.
And the jury is definitely in on him being the next permanent EPA chief, right?
Yes, what I can predict with confidence is that he will be confirmed by the Senate. While he's definitely not going to get a significant number of Democratic votes, Republicans have a greater margin now than they did last time. And frankly, privately, many Democrats will admit that it's not like they would get someone who is more favorable to their issues.
Juliet, thank you.
Of course, Madeline.
That's Juliet Alperin. She's senior national affairs correspondent for The Washington Post. Coming up, why the head of the Saturday's Women's March LA decided to go on with the march despite an anti-Semitism scandal in the national organization.
For me as a Latina Jew, it was important that I represent both my communities. It was important that my community stand with me, and so far they are.
How the Women's March fractured. Next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Well, this Saturday, the third Women's March takes place in cities across the nation, including the nation's capital, but under a cloud. There have been allegations of anti-Semitism and calls for some of the top leaders to step down. One of them, Tamika Mallory, has associated with Nation of Islam leader Louis Farrakhan. Farrakhan has called Jews termites. He says they financed the slave trade. And he called Hitler a very great man. When asked on The View this week if she would condemn Farrakhan's comments, Mallory said this.
What I will say to you is that I don't agree with many of Minister Farrakhan's statements.
Specifically about Jewish people.
As I said, I don't agree with many of Minister Farrakhan's statements.
Do you condemn them?
I don't agree with these statements. At the end of the day...
You won't condemn it.
No. To be very clear, it's not my language. It's not the way that I speak. It is not how I organize.
There have been calls for Mallory to step down, but she has refused. She says she doesn't want to disappoint her supporters. Another leader, Carmen Perez, has also faced calls to resign for similar allegations of anti-Semitism. The Women's March is the name of the national organization. Local chapters with the same name and same logo operate independently. And so they now face a dilemma. Should they hold the march as planned or cancel it? Well, one chapter, the Washington State chapter, decided to dissolve its organization altogether. As leader of the Washington State chapter, Angie Beam led this move to dissolve her own organization, and she joins me now. Hi.
Hi, thank you.
Thanks for joining us. Well, let's begin at the beginning, which was probably just after President Trump was elected in 2016. How did you get involved with the Women's March?
It was actually before he was elected, and it was even before he was named the nominee for the Republican Party, where I was finding people that I had respected and loved suddenly being racist and making racist statements. And so I started paying close attention to what they were posting on Facebook. I realized there was a direct connection to the actual presidential election cycle. So I started paying closer attention. And whenever I started seeing the way that Trump and a few others were acting, as soon as Trump made fun of that disabled reporter, mm-hmm. that was sort of the end for me. And so I started Googling, trying to figure out what we can do to stop this. You know, and I found Women's March, and I asked them if they were having one here. I live in Spokane, Washington, and they said, if you want to lead it, we can. And so that's where it started, and I quickly became the state team, and then also quickly the board president.
And then you organized the two previous marches?
Well, so we at the state level, we support individual cities. Mm-hmm. So like Seattle, after the first year, they were self-sufficient, and so they didn't need our help anymore. And then this year, Spokane is also self-sufficient, so they don't need our help anymore. And we have a couple of cities that decided they were going to go to either Olympia or Portland. So we're just actually supporting three cities this year.
All right. And what was your relationship with the national organization, with these four women who run it, two of whom have faced calls to resign for allegations of anti-Semitism?
I asked them to step down in an email almost immediately after Tamika Mallory sided herself with Farrakhan. We talked about it. We tried to keep it internal, and they wouldn't, as you saw in The View, they still haven't. They won't denounce him. They just won't back down. They've dug their heels in, and that's when we realized that, you know what, we're not going to get them to change. We're powerless to get them out. We can't vote them out. We can't ask them, you know, we can't fire them. We can't do anything like that. So me and my board decided that the best way we can do that is to take a firm stand and just say, we're going to dissolve. What it's done, though, is it's created sort of an internal battle, because like right now, I'm not going to participate in a march, and neither am I board. But the problem is we had already promised these cities that we would support them. So it's kind of like, you know, my conscience is kind of torn in two, because I'm only as good as my word. I have to keep my promise. But at the same time, this isn't what Women's March was built for. It wasn't made so that we can just perpetuate racism and anti-Semitism.
Hmm. Well, it's really tough to hear that, because this is a movement founded on the idea of inclusion and the idea of respecting human rights, as you were outlining earlier, respecting people. And that's why you became an activist, because you saw Donald Trump not doing that.
Right. It was so life-changing. I mean, to build something like that, to give birth to such a powerful movement like that, it was so emotional, that first march. I cried the whole time. It was so emotional, and it meant so much to me. And so it's not an easy decision to walk away. So I know that's why not everybody is, because it's really not. I just hope that we can somehow just get them to step down.
Is there any way you could rebrand, not associate with the National Women's March, just be your own organization statewide in Washington?
We considered it, and you know, who knows what the future is going to hold, but for right now, we feel that our best firm stance and our biggest, loudest voice is to just say, we won't stand for this, we're done.
And when did you first bring this up internally?
So with National, it was right after Tamika, that's February of 2018. We started saying, what is going on, you know, and then we had a very intense field call shortly after that. And that is where Tamika pled her case. And as some of us were able to give input towards the end, and that got hard, it got intense. And one lady in particular was very vocal about how wrong it is for them to align with the Nation of Islam and Farrakhan. And she was just so brave and so bold, and I was just cheering her on. I can't remember what state she was with, but at that point, Tamika just sort of like didn't say anything at all anymore. And the other two, Bob and Carmen, they supported her and basically protected her, rallied around her, you know, and it was becoming very clear that they have no intention of saying, you know what, we screwed up. We all have our unpacking to do. It was a perfect opportunity to do that, to say, we're all growing, you know, please forgive me, we'll do better. But no, they dug their heels in. And so we continued to try to get them to either denounce Farrakhan and the Nation of Islam or step down. And we just couldn't do it. So this is the only power that we have, is to just say, no,
What about the idea that, yeah, this is bad, that one of the founders of the organization went to the Savior's Day event in February 2018, this Farrakhan event, and has refused to condemn his remarks, etc.? Yeah, that's terrible. But the overall march is really more important than that.
I agree. I think that the movement is important, and I hope that this doesn't end it. I just hope that enough people take a stand to where they will step down so it can be the movement it was intended to be.
Well, thank you so much for speaking with us today. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
That's Angie Beam. She's president of the board of the Women's March in Washington State. Let's turn now to our local chapter here in Los Angeles. Emiliana Guerreca is the executive director of the Women's March LA. Welcome.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
Well, it's great to have you. You just heard that interview. What's your reaction to her decision to basically dissolve her chapter because of this anti-Semitism controversy?
Right. So I think we all have, you know, choices to make as we move forward in the movement, because it is a movement and it represents more than four women, right? For me, I don't have an option to dissolve. I think that Los Angeles has so many issues that we need to focus on as an organization. Is it tough explaining all of this? Absolutely. But for us, we don't have the option of dissolving. We need to confront and be part of the solution with all of this.
Have you had tough conversations with local Jewish organizations, women, synagogues, people who want to participate who are now questioning whether they should attend?
Absolutely. So myself and Dina Katz, we are both of the Jewish faith, raising our children in the Jewish faith as well. We're deeply committed to continue to organize, because if we step away, I think that our voices get missed. And the original intent as to why we started organizing was because we did not want our voices to not be heard. For me as a Latina Jew, it was important that I represent both my communities. It was important that my community stand with me, and so far they are. I have had some pretty tough discussions with different organizations, different Jewish organizations, that want to know where we stand. And when we talk to them about who we are, how we organize, they realize that we have always been a separate entity, that we have never had a part of who Women's March, Inc. is.
But I think regular people, and maybe even these people you spoke with until you educated them on this, don't really know that there is a difference.
Correct. And that,
because it's the same name. You have the same name.
Correct. And that has been part of the challenge. We do have the same name, and we also share branding. But this was something that we all, when we all decided to organize, we were organizing under the name Women's March. No one owns the name. No one owns the movement. So, yeah, I do get that it's difficult to understand that we would be, you know, separate organizations. But at the same time, our work on the ground in L.A. speaks for itself.
But I understand the National Women's March does want to trademark the name.
So I'm going to correct that. There is no national organization. Everyone is operating under their own separate organizations. What is now known as Women's March National is actually Women's March, Inc., being run out of New York. And yes, they have applied for a trademark. Los Angeles, along with other organizations, have filed a lawsuit to prevent that.
Why did you do that?
Because no one organization or one entity should own the movement. This movement was for everyone.
Do you think that Tamika Mallory should step down?
I think Tamika Mallory needs to decide that on her own.
But would you like to see her step down? Do you think that she is too much of a lightning rod at this point and too much of a negative presence, a distraction from your goals?
I think that that is for Tamika and her board to decide. I do not have a space in their leadership, right, or their organization or part of their board. I think that their board needs to decide how the organization is going to move and grow. is it with Tamika on board or is it with Tamika off the board, right? So their own organization needs to come to terms and make some really tough decisions.
Can you just give us a sense of how this has roiled your organization since this came to light?
Well, we have had, you know, like we were speaking on the tough conversations that we've had. We have had some people drop off funding. We are all self-funded, so funding has definitely been an issue, as well as credibility issues. Like, what do we really stand for? Who are we really? And, I mean, we are a very new organization and do not have the answers for everything. I also think we're all going through growing pains. All movements tend to splinter after a while. Once we all figure out how we're going to move forward as an organization, my hope is that we have a true national organization with true national leadership.
Which you don't have right now.
Correct.
Okay, tell us about what's happening on Saturday. How many people are you expecting? Who will be speaking?
Right, so we are expecting over 100,000 people. We are having first partner Jennifer Seibel Newsom attend. We are having a few celebrities, a ton of grassroots organizers. We have a contingent of TSA employees. We can't forget about the government shutdown. We all do have a contingent of teachers. We have a teacher strike in LA. So again, our march will be very, very much representative of LA issues.
Well, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
That's Emiliana Guereca, Executive Director of Women's March LA. And joining us now is Warren Olney, host of To The Point, the podcast.
Hello.
Hello. What's on your show?
Well, we're going to be talking about the government shutdown, which is not too popular, and the wall is getting less and less popular as a result of that. On the other hand, the Trump base is still very supportive, particularly Christian conservatives. And other elements of the Trump base also are supporting it, and it has a lot to do with the changing demographic and cultural nature of America. People are afraid that the country is becoming something different from what it used to be. It's all about race and religion, and it's a very complicated, very interesting issue.
So wondering if they are okay with the shutdown, the people who are supporting Donald Trump and the wall, are they okay with the shutdown too?
I think polls show less and less as the consequences become apparent, not just from government workers who aren't getting their pay, but services that aren't being performed.
All right. Thank you. That is Warren Olney, and he hosts the podcast To The Point, which you can get it wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you.
Okay.
Coming up, we talked about the Women's March happening on Saturday. There's another big event this weekend on Sunday, the NFL playoff game between the Rams and the Saints. One of them will go to the Super Bowl. Next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand.
The sound of a cheering crowd tells it all.
The Rams. Yes, the LA Rams could make it to the Super Bowl. They just have to get through the Saints this weekend. Here to talk about that. Well, you know, you've heard the music. It's the Sklar Brothers.
Hi, Madeline.
Hi, you guys.
This is very exciting. The Rams are on the precipice of potentially being in the Super Bowl. All they have to do is go to a very difficult place to play,
yes.
A place where they already lost this year by 10
this
points.
This is New Orleans.
New Orleans. This is New Orleans. New Orleans is unbelievable at home.
So they're the underdogs.
The Rams are the underdogs by 3.5 points, so more than a field goal if you're betting. And the truth of the matter is, it's a tall order. The Saints, once the Saints locked up the number one seed in the NFC, you said their pathway to the Super Bowl was a very easy one because they play all their home games and they're almost impossible to beat at home. And you have the experience of Drew Brees. We saw it on the other side with the AFC. Everyone thought, well, we thought even the Chargers were the upstart team that might beat the Patriots. Well, look out.
Tom Brady was
a guy
just like,
who's been there before.
And then Tom Brady in the post-game interview was like, yeah, everybody said we suck. He had to get that in there.
Yeah.
That
everyone doubted us.
So what's amazing about Tom Brady on that other side, just for a second, is the Patriots
have been in this AFC Championship game 8 years in a row. Right. They've won so many Super Bowls. He will go down as the GOAT, the greatest, and yet he still manages to play with this chip on his shoulder that people aren't maybe giving us enough credit.
Maybe that's what gets him through.
It is what motivates
him. So maybe the Rams need to play with that.
So they're playing the Chiefs. That's
they play the
game.
Chiefs. So, you know, really, as a fan of sports and whatnot, you always love to see new blood kind of
into
so
the Super Bowl.
A Chiefs-Rams Super Bowl, and they played in the season and had an unbelievable game, the Chiefs and the Rams.
Who won?
Rams won.
Chiefs-Rams Super Bowl would be amazing because you've got two powerful offenses, two great young quarterbacks.
I mean, there could be 110 points scored in a game like that.
It would just be like the most amazing thing. So there are a lot of good matchups. I mean, even the Chiefs-Saints would be a great one because it would be a great offensive thing. But again, if it's Drew Brees versus Tom Brady, you say to yourself, you got two of the Hall of Fame quarterbacks for if they're playing each other.
The four best teams are remaining in the playoffs.
Okay, well, tell us what's going to happen on Sunday.
You know, I think if the Rams find a way to stop Drew Brees, and we say hold the Saints to under 28 points,
they've got a shot.
They have a real shot.
So can Jared Goff do that?
Jared Goff is a quarterback. Hopefully he can play well, and the key is they have Todd Gurley healthy. Todd Gurley, the running back, who apparently it was just kind of released that he hurt his knee pretty badly earlier in the year, and they really didn't disclose out.
He played on the hurt
swelled up like a grapefruit, and he's playing on this bad knee and trying to play through it. And then finally the Rams said, we got to shut you down for a few games.
And they lost
a couple games because Todd Gurley is amazing. He's really one of the best.
But he's back.
He's back. He's full speed. So this is really good for the Rams.
Okay.
Knee is
fine. Now shrunk down to a lemon.
Now it's maybe
a
lemon
or a lime.
Maybe a persimmon. But let's get into fruit sizes here. But the whole point is that he actually presents for Jared Goff. He makes Jared Goff better because the threat of Todd Gurley running means that the defense has to respect that and honor it and put guys on the defensive line, which gives you one-on-one options on the outside. And the Rams skill receivers like Robert Woods, you know, you got guys like Robert Woods and Brandon Cooks. These are guys who can beat
their one-on-one
matchups. And Goff has really become a great precise quarterback. So that's the way. And again, when you run the ball, you control the clock a little bit better.
If you can run the ball and eat up some of that clock, then you're keeping a Hall of Fame quarterback, Drew Brees, off the field. You're keeping their defense on the field and tiring them out throughout.
So that's one way that the Rams can win.
Could
be an
so
even
there's
game.
Strategy in this
of
game.
Course.
Oh, there is strategy. I'll say last week's game with the Eagles and the Saints. The Eagles actually held the Saints in their home. The Saints were at home, held them in New Orleans really well until the end of the third quarter, and then the Saints kind of pulled away. And I think the Eagles just didn't have the offensive firepower to match that. The Rams do. So they'll watch that game very closely and say, what did the Eagles do right defensively to hold the Saints? And then they'll see if they can do that.
Okay. Should we move on to basketball? Because
let's do it.
Where's LeBron? He's been gone for 11 games.
Nursing a groin.
Yes.
His groin.
Not nursing someone else's
family show.
Groin.
I know, but he is nursing his. LeBron has not had an injury that has caused him to be out for what may be, they're looking at maybe 13 games in his entire career. That's not good news for LA. LeBron is human. He is getting older.
And without LeBron, LA, the Lakers have lost to teams like the Knicks, who are terrible, and
the Cavs, who are god awful.
Well, let's talk about that because last year they made it to the finals, and now they are what? The worst.
Yeah. It just tells you how powerful.
So basically, it's the LeBron Cavaliers.
The LeBron effect. And, you know, Kevin Love has been hurt. He's a great player on the Cavs, but he hasn't been that great. And just the team is not.
Without LeBron, they are not a playoff team. And that's sort of the same deal with the Lakers. They're going to get LeBron back, though. And, you know, anything's possible with LeBron in the lineup, like we say.
They're
ninth
now. You got to be the top eight, make the playoffs. And by the way, the Clippers are seventh. But listen, I'll put it in terms of this. The Lakers are seven games out of first place, which is the Golden State Warriors, and Golden State is now starting to put things together. And
I mean, Golden State scored 51 points in one quarter.
I was going to ask you about that. So that's early this week.
51 points in one quarter.
10 three-pointers in one quarter.
Set a record. Broke the record that they set a week earlier. I mean, this team is
I was watching
a
one-minuter online looking at the highlights, and they just look like it looks so easy.
It's like a video game.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, because they have several guys. You got to guard Kevin Durant, and if you guard Kevin Durant, then that leaves Steph Curry open, and if you guard him, then that leaves Klay Thompson open, and if you guard him, that's just what it is.
They all know how to do the three-point.
Everybody is a great three-point shooter. Everybody knows how to expose the defense. Guys know how to drive the lane and then kick it back out to open shooters. It's a wonderful system where balls are, you know, the movement of balls. Steve Kerr is a great coach, and their whole offense is predicated on nice ball movement, which
a ball can move faster than guys can run on the court. So if you hit an open man who's got a wide open shot,
and he's going to knock it down. Shots.
And when they're all hitting their shots, they score 51 points in a quarter, which is just video game numbers.
So I guess they won that game.
They did win that game. But on the flip side, you say, okay, who can challenge them? Well, Houston has a guy named James Harden who has been playing out of his mind, easily the MVP of the league if it were to stop right now.
But the other night he scored 58 points and they lost to the Nets.
To the Brooklyn Nets. And you say to yourself, wait a minute, this guy scored 58 points and your team loses? Well, because it was too individual of a sport. Wasn't passing it around like, again, the
other guys weren't getting involved. And other teams are going to say, even the Golden State Warriors, hey, give James Harden his 40, 50 points.
If you can stop everybody else, you can win that game. Now, that same thing can apply to LeBron. And that is why LeBron needs to get back, because he needs to get other guys involved and he needs to get the team involved. And they still have a real legitimate shot to make the playoffs this year.
Okay. I think you guys got it all in.
We got it in.
So much in. Sklar Brothers, Randy and Jason, check out their sports podcast, View from the Cheap Seats. Okay, Christian Bordahl is here, and we're going to do something a little bit different, not just regular feedback. We're going to take a moment to remember the poet Mary Oliver today. She was 83 years old. She died today, and kind of a poet rock star.
She was. She won the National Book Award. She won the Pulitzer Prize. More unusual than that, though, she was one of the few poets who actually sold books.
Well, that's helpful.
And her readings were mobbed, and she had celebrities that were big fans, and that's probably in part because her poems generally weren't very long, and the language of them was quite plain and direct, which is something I think people appreciated.
But I think poetry critics, the snobs of the poetry world, they were kind of not into her.
Yeah, that's true. And she responded to that by saying, look, the way I feel is that poetry shouldn't be fancy, that it should be clear and understandable.
Okay, so she wrote some beautiful poems about the natural world.
That
poems,
was a big focus
yeah,
of hers. Yeah,
poems like called Egrets, The Swan, The Waterfall, The Summer Day. And you're going to read one, right?
I have brought one along to read. Yes.
Good. Let's hear it.
Okay, here we go. This poem is called In Blackwater Woods, and it goes like this. Look, the trees are turning their own bodies into pillars of light, are giving off the rich fragrance of cinnamon and fulfillment. The long tapers of cattails are bursting and floating away over the blue shoulders of the ponds, and every pond, no matter what its name is nameless now. Every year, everything I have ever learned in my lifetime leads back to this. The fires and the black river of loss, whose other side is salvation, whose meaning none of us will ever know. To live in this world, you must be able to do three things. To love what is mortal, to hold it against your bones, knowing your own life depends on it, and, when the time comes, to let it go. To let it go.
That is beautiful.
Yeah.
And also a beautiful reading of
that
poem.
Thank you.
Yeah. So had you been a fan of hers before?
You know, I've read a little bit of Mary Oliver, but I haven't read a whole lot. And now I'm going to have to go back, I think, and read some of these poems because I love that one. And I love some of the others that I was reading before we got together today.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, Christian Bordahl. Remembering Mary Oliver. Thank you for listening. I'm Madeline Brand. I'll see you tomorrow.